A boy preached sermons to chickens on an Alabama farm, conducting funerals for the ones that died and attempting baptisms in creek water. His family thought it peculiar, but young John Lewis was practicing for something far greater than anyone could imagine. That same boy would grow up to have his skull fractured on a bridge in Selma, stand beside Martin Luther King Jr. at the March on Washington, and serve in Congress for over three decades. Yet what made Lewis extraordinary wasn't just his courage or his achievements, it was his unshakable belief that love could defeat hate, that suffering could redeem, and that ordinary people could bend the arc of history toward justice. In an age of cynicism and division, Lewis's life poses an urgent question. Can faith-inspired nonviolence still transform a broken nation? The answer lies not in distant theory, but in understanding how one man's commitment to what he called good trouble reshaped American democracy. What defines a saint in modern America? Not plaster figures in stained glass, but someone willing to suffer for others in service of something greater. John Lewis met this test repeatedly, his body bearing scars from over 40 arrests and countless beatings. Yet he rejected the view that injustice was inevitable, embracing instead the radical possibility that the world could be transformed. Inspired by the Beatitudes and Jesus's example, Lewis transformed persecution into soul force, love made active and dangerous. In 1975, Time magazine named him among living saints, alongside Mother Teresa. Religious historian Martin Marty observed that a saint has to be a misfit, someone embodying what culture considers impossible. Lewis's willingness to sit at segregated lunch counters and march into violence certainly qualified. For John Lewis, slavery wasn't ancient history. His great-grandfather Frank Carter was born enslaved in 1862 and lived until Lewis was seven. Despite emancipation, Carter came of age during Reconstruction and Jim Crow, when Alabama's black codes reestablished white supremacy under different names. Lewis's parents weren't revolutionaries. His father, Eddie, worked as a sharecropper, his mother's hands split and hardened from picking cotton for $1.40 per 400 pounds. In 1944, his father bought 110 acres. Their new home had three rooms with cracks in the floorboards, no electricity, and water from a well. Young Lewis was assigned to care for the chickens, and this chore became intertwined with his growing spiritual vocation. He preached to the poultry, conducted funerals, and attempted baptisms. I don't think there's any way to estimate how much that experience taught me about discipline and responsibility and patience, he later reflected. Church provided transcendence. Hymns like Amazing Grace and stories of enslavement transported him beyond muddy roads. Given a Bible at age four, he was drawn to Genesis and John's Gospel. But school revealed stark contrasts: shiny fountains for whites, rusty spigots for coloreds. When his uncle took him to Buffalo at age 11, he glimpsed integrated neighborhoods, concrete evidence that alternatives to Jim Crow existed. When Brown v. Board of Education passed in 1954, 14-year-old Lewis wanted to jump for joy, but nothing changed. His church focused on heavenly salvation rather than earthly justice. Then he heard Martin Luther King Jr. on the radio, preaching that Christians owe ultimate allegiance to God, not man. "When I heard King, it was as though a light turned on in my heart," Lewis recalled. King's social gospel theology demanded action. When 15-year-old Emmett Till was murdered in August 1955, Lewis was haunted. "He could have been me." At American Baptist Theological Seminary in Nashville, Lewis washed dishes for $42.50 monthly. Professor John Lewis Powell taught him Hegel's dialectic: segregation as thesis, struggle as antithesis, integration as synthesis. In summer 1958, he met King, who warned of dangers but promised support. That fall, James Lawson, who had studied Gandhi's methods in India, led workshops in nonviolent resistance that transformed Lewis. Hate is too heavy a burden to bear. Lewis, King, and Lawson envisioned the beloved community, a concept from philosopher Josiah Royce representing God's kingdom on earth, controlled by the law of love, featuring equality and respect for human dignity regardless of race. Lewis trained at Tennessee's Highlander Folk School, where Rosa Parks had found transformative strength before the Montgomery boycott. Lawson's training was rigorous. He showed us how to curl our bodies so that our internal organs would escape direct blows. Lawson taught that nonviolence required transformation. You have to do more than just not hit back. You have to have no desire to hit back. You have to love that person who's hitting you. Lewis's first test came during the Nashville sit-ins of 1959-60. After arrest, he and 80 others chose jail over fines. "We feel that if we pay these fines," Diane Nash declared, "we would be contributing to and supporting the injustice." On November 10, 1960, Lewis and James Bevel nearly died when a Crystal restaurant manager locked them inside and activated an insecticide fumigator. Not yet 21, Lewis reflected, "I was not eager to die, but I was at peace with the prospect of it." In March 1961, Lewis joined the Freedom Ride, challenging segregation on interstate buses. On May 4th, the integrated group departed with toothbrushes, books, and Lewis's Bible. In Rock Hill, South Carolina, when Lewis entered through the white door, he was attacked, struck in the face, and kicked as he fell. Despite his injuries, he refused to press charges. "We're not here to cause trouble. We're here so that people will love each other." On May 13th, Klansmen firebombed the Greyhound bus in Anniston, Alabama, shouting, "Burn them alive." When Lewis and Diane Nash learned the Freedom Riders had been evacuated, they refused to let violence defeat nonviolence. Despite Robert Kennedy's 5 a.m. call demanding they stop, Nash remained resolute. "We all signed our wills last night. We know somebody will die, but we are not going to let nonviolence be overcome by violence." The defining moment came at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. At 25, Lewis faced state troopers who ordered them to disperse. "We cannot jump. We're going to have to keep marching." A billy club fractured his skull. He vomited, heard screams and horses' hooves, believing, "I'm going to die here." Yet he felt only peace. "I thought I saw death, and I thought, it's okay, it's all right. I am doing what I am supposed to do." That evening, ABC interrupted its broadcast to show footage of the assault. On March 15th, President Johnson addressed Congress on voting rights, concluding, "And we shall overcome." Lewis and King watched together, tears streaming down their faces. Despite his injuries, Lewis walked the entire 54 miles from Selma to Montgomery. On August 6th, Johnson invited Lewis to witness the signing of the Voting Rights Act. Lewis's vision proved prophetic when Watts erupted days after the Voting Rights Act passed. SNCC voted him out in 1966 as Black Power gained momentum. "It hurt to leave my family," he reflected. "I felt abandoned, cast out." He won an Atlanta City Council seat in 1981 and later a U.S. House seat that defined his career. In Congress, he remained a principled activist, arrested 5 times as a representative for protesting apartheid, genocide, and immigration injustice. He preserved movement history through his graphic novel trilogy, March, and spoke passionately during Trump's impeachment. "When you see something that is not right, not just, not fair, you have a moral obligation to say something, to do something." In 2020, a frail Lewis wept at George Floyd's killing, but maintained hope in young protesters redeeming America's soul. Even facing death from cancer, he maintained unwavering optimism. "We've come too far. We've made too much progress as a people to stand still or to slip back." The boy who preached to chickens had shown the world that love, wielded with courage, remains the most powerful force for change.